many years of forcing thoughts of his children from his consciousness, Sam didn't know what to think about Alice's entering the convent. Helen had heard it from Mrs. Arkaday when she brought a bag of tomatoes over to the rectory for the Monsignor. Of course it wasn't official, but when the Monsignor had asked, Father Gannon had confided that he was helping Alice with her vocation. Mrs. Arkaday said she shouldn't say anything, but she knew Helen would be thrilled with the news. If anyone deserved a member of the religious in her life, it was Helen LaChance. Mrs. Arkaday asked her to please pass on her congratulations to Sam. At first he'd been depressed, embarrassed not to have known, then proud. And now he was frightened. Somehow this was his fault. He had forced his daughter into an austere and sterile existence. Just when he was rebuilding his life, she would leave and become a stranger to him. But wasn't she already a stranger? He had pushed her away. He still remembered that day at Applegate and the stricken look on her face as he hurried into the dining room. He wanted to call Marie before he left for work. He started past the crib where his mother sat propped against pillows, her eyes closed, as Helen tried to feed her. Every day her breathing worsened with wheezing so torturously long and deep that her jaw would tremble and her teeth would rattle. He was sure she was dying, but Helen insisted it was the same cold she herself had endured all week. Yesterday he had watched Helen trying to spoon-feed broth into that gaping mouth. Her trembling chin and neck had glistened with the yellow liquid. She was in a coma, he had told his sister, who insisted their mother's deep sleep was the result of being awake at night when he was at work. "Then feed her at night when she's awake," he told Helen, "but don't submit her to such indignities." Helen insisted she had tried, but when Bridget was awake, she wouldn't open her mouth. "Then at least use an eyedropper or something," he had said, surprised now to find his advice heeded as Helen squirted broth from an eyedropper down the back of Bridget's throat. She kept gagging and choking.
"Hello,"
answered Marie on the first ring.
"It's me,"
he said softly. He didn't want Helen to hear him. Just a few feet away, light glowed around the door to Renee's room, where a ball game sputtered from the radio.
"Omar? Omar, where are you?"
"It's Sam."
For a moment he was confused. Then he remembered who Omar was.
"Oh,"
she said in a flat voice.
"You sound tired,"
he said, forestalling news of Alice, wanting at least a few moments of pleasant conversation. Not tired, she told him, but exhausted. Her car had broken down, and she was having to drive Norm's junk. And then Astrid had quit last week, so now she had the bookkeeping to do as well as her own work. Astrid? He couldn't put a face to the name. Entire months had been lost. He felt his confidence ebb. If he told her about Alice, she would blame him. He'd never been a father to them. What did he expect? He tried to tell her about his job. Now that he had established his own rhythm with the loader, the hours passed quickly. The night watchman continued to be a problem, but...
"Sam, what about the money? Did you talk to Helen? Is that why you're calling?"
"Well, I've been working on the figures to show her."
He thought he heard Marie groan. He cupped the mouthpiece with his hand.
"Mother's very sick," he whispered. "Helen says no, but I think she's in a coma."
She didn't say anything.
"This may be it," he said, throwing the old hook. Anything to keep her believing, anything but action.
"I don't know what to say. I'm sorry, Sam, and whatever happens, you can't let it destroy you."
"It won't,"
he sighed, flushing with the old warmth of her attention. He couldn't remember when he'd last heard caring words from her. He closed his eyes.
"You've been doing so well."
"I know,"
he said, smiling.
"You've really been trying."
"I have,"
he said, grateful for her acknowledgement.
"She's lived a long life, and these last few years haven't been pleasant ones."
"No, they haven't."
"How's Helen handling it?"
"Oh, typically. It's just a cold, she says, that's all."
"Maybe she's right. Of course, at her age, even a cold could be terrible."
"Marie, I called to find out about something. I heard something. It's about Alice."
"What? What about her?"
He repeated what the Monsignor's housekeeper had told Helen.
Oh, my God! No, that's impossible. It can't be true.
But that's what the priest said. That's what he told the Monsignor.
I wondered why he was giving her rides and coming around so much. And here I was beginning to think he was, well, oh, God, what's wrong with her?
Well, she's always been a quiet kind of kid, a good girl,
a coward,
Marie spat, and his ear rang with the familiar sibilance.
Always trying to find the easy way out.
Marie, she's not a bad person because she wants to become a nun.
She doesn't want to become a nun,
she said with a bitter laugh he remembered only too well.
She just doesn't want to have to work. She just doesn't want to have to go to college. She just doesn't want to have to listen to me anymore.
No, Marie.
It's true. She wants to hide, just like the rest of them. They haven't got a backbone between them, the three of them. Well, I'm sick of being the only one who cares, the only one who tries. Oh, God!
There was a long, wet sob, and then she hung up.
Top of the seventh, and the Yankees lead 8-3.
Rini's radio announced in a sudden swell of clarity from his room. Sam laid out 4 pieces of bread for tonight's sandwiches, the 4 thin slices of ham, 2 of Swiss cheese. He spread the thinnest skim of mustard on it all, then wrapped the sandwiches in waxed paper and put them in the same brown bag used every night to achieve the constancy, monotony enough, to keep from feeling the grooves or seeing the strings. If Alice wanted to hide, the convent was one hell of a better choice than booze. He returned the ham to the refrigerator and wiped crumbs from the counter. He covered the butter dish and switched off the light over the sink. Now that Alice wouldn't be needing money for school, his campaign of annoyance was over. Imagine, Sam Vermoyle's daughter, a nun. He grinned. Now wouldn't that make people sit up and take notice? On Sunday, the church was only half filled for the 11 o'clock Mass. Because of the heat, most people had gone to the early Masses and were now probably sitting on the beaches at the lakes and ponds. The consecration was over. Father Gannon turned to face the congregants. Accompanied by the altar boy, he carried the host-filled chalice down the wide, crimson-carpeted steps to the marble communion rail. As he placed the small white host on each quivering tongue, he would glance up from time to time. When he came to the end of the rail, he turned back to begin again. Pausing, he smiled, relieved to see Alice in the last pew, her head bent over her folded hands. Last night he had talked her into at least attending Mass, even if she would not receive communion. What they shared was not only beautiful but sacred, he had told her. He might think so, she had countered, but the church said it was a sin. Some things transcend the church's scope, he had said. What? He had wanted her to ask. What things? So that he could tell her. Love did. Love. Instead, she had burrowed into that frustrating remoteness of hers.
Corpus Domini Nostri Jesu Christi,
he murmured over a kneeling child with long dark pigtails. Seeing Alice look up, he paused, still holding the host above the child's head. The child stuck out her tongue. He couldn't help but smile. Alice's pale face glowed from the shadowed depths below the choir loft like a keyhole of light from which he could not look away. The child looked up. Alice bent so far forward that her forehead met her clenched hands.
Father,
the child whispered loudly. All along the rail, the communicant stared up at him.
Why won't you give me communion?
The child asked. The heat filled every room in the Stoner house but Carol's. Here the windows were closed, the shades and curtains drawn. On the cluttered bureau, a silver fan oscillated in a gentle rattle between the closed door and the small mound in the bed. For the past hour, she had been trying to wet her lips with her tongue, but she couldn't. The door opened. It was Sunny. He tiptoed in and leaned over the bed. His cool fingertips trickled down her cheeks. Her eyes moved from the glinting badge on his chest to the wide belt and holster at his hip, the black gun butt.
Kill me. Take it out. Shoot me,
she was screaming. You're a good girl, he whispered in the maddening silence.
Do it. Do it like that deer that was hit up on the post road.
They had found it writhing in the stony gully, a bloody gash in its side, legs twitching, its mournful eyes following the quick, wordless arc of Sonny's aim.
Don't look! Don't look! Don't look now, Carol!
Closing her eyes, her head had jerked back with each blast.
Pow! Pow! Pow!
The door closed after him with a whoosh of air and light.
I am a poor, dumb creature, too,
she screamed. But in the quiet, no one heard. The hood was raised, and Norm was cleaning the spark plugs with gasoline. He spent all his free time working on the engine. Now that this had become the family car, he felt an enormous responsibility to keep it running. His mother might have to wait for Omar's soap, her investment that had impoverished them, but it was his car that got her back and forth to work every day. He had been daydreaming about Astrid Haddad. He'd almost convinced himself that Benji had misinterpreted everything. But then, when Astrid quit her job, his mother said she couldn't help thinking it had something to do with her. She said Astrid couldn't seem to look her straight in the eye anymore. Norm knew what it was. She'd quit because of him. Twice last night he'd parked down the street from her house, staring at the light streaming through her filmy curtains, trying to work up the courage to ring her doorbell. Never had he felt lonelier than in these past 2 weeks. Sometimes it seemed that there was a hole so big inside him nothing would ever fill it. When he was done with the car, he ate supper, and then he drove slowly around the park to see if any of his friends were at the band concert. It was a cool, starry night, with enough of a breeze so that people stood shivering with their blankets around their shoulders. Many had begun to leave. As he came down West Street, he was surprised to see Joey Selden sitting on his stool. Victor, the cop, stood next to the stand with his arms folded. It had been a week since Joey had been ordered to vacate the stand. Each day another town official came to reason with him, but Joey would have no part of their hypocritical logic. He had an agreement, a contract with the town, and it was the town that had failed to meet its own stipulations, he explained to anyone who'd listen. Even Friday's editorial in the Atkinson Crier was calling for a re-examination of this most sensitive issue. Norm parked the car and was reading the editorial, which was tacked on one of the corner posts.
See?
Joey said, poking a hand out between the boards. He pointed to the last line.
See what it says here? The shameful condition of the stand in the park represents the town's dereliction of responsibility to one of its most colorful citizens. Hey, that's pretty good, Joey, he said, pitying the old man's proud grin. And for a minute, he didn't know what to say. So, how's the new car?
Joey asked.
Great. Course, I got some work to do on it. The timing's all off. As well as most of the paint, Joey said, laughing, and Norm didn't say anything.
Their eyes met, and Joey looked away.
Here,
Joey said, handing him a bag of popcorn.
It's on the house,
he said with an unmistakable glance at the dime Norm held out. Up in the bandstand, Jardin Green's arms were a blur as the musicians played the syncopated clock faster and faster. Green kept glancing back at the steady stream of people leaving the park.
He thinks if the band plays louder and faster, they'll all stay,
Joey laughed. Norm looked at him. How had he known? Just by all the car doors opening and shutting. Engine starting, of course. After all these years, Joey knew all the sounds. All you had to do was say hello, and Joey'd know if you were happy or sad.
Want some help with the empties? They're all over the place, he said, picking up a bottle. That's not even mine, Joey said. What?
He asked slowly.
What's not yours? That bottle you got.
What is it? He asked.
Kelly's limeade. How do you know? By the smell.
Joey said with an exaggerated wink and a grin. Norm looked away. Could it be that he wasn't blind? That it had been a scam all these years? An act? He probably was getting a kickback the night Towler still blew up.
Norm thought of all the times he'd crated Joey's empties, guided him across the busy West Street intersection, felt so trustworthy to be able to count his money at the end of the night, when the whole time Joey'd been watching him like a hawk. He remembered his anger at Jardine Green's insistence that Joey's mugging had been staged. The old man probably tripped and fell and then said he'd been robbed so that people would feel so sorry for him they'd stop trying to close his stand. Nothing but a phony. A con man like Duval, milking people's kindness.
"Well, I gotta go now, Joey."
He tossed the popcorn into the barrel, certain he saw the old man wince.
"Wait, let me get you a Coke, then."
"No, thanks," he said, calling goodbye as he headed up the street.
"How about a 7-Up, then?"
"I'm not thirsty," he called. And when he got to the hot dog bus, he stopped at the window and ordered a raspberry freeze. He turned with a tall frosted cup, and sure enough, Joey watched sadly. He looked right at the old man, forced a quick cold smile before turning away. Renee stared at the ceiling. In the kitchen, Sam and Helen argued right outside his door. Water was running into a pan. Helen had just called Dr. Reynolds about her mother's congestion.
"Congestion?" Sam roared. "She can barely breathe. Will you face the facts, Helen? Mother's dying."
The linoleum made squeaky sticking sounds as Sam paced back and forth. Renee knew their footsteps, their sighs, and which closing door had been shut by whom. Surely now Sam followed his sister from chore to chore. At their most agitated, each would be hard upon the other's tender heels.
"Sorry to disappoint you, dear brother, but Mother is not dying. She has a cold, a very bad cold, which Dr. Reynolds is treating."
Helen's voice quavered.
"What's he going to do? Give her another shot?"
Sam shouted.
"Yes, give her another shot. The penicillin's working."
"Come on, Helen."
"Oh, and what's your solution? You're so involved. Tell me what to do,"
Helen said, and a cupboard door banged shut, all the cups tinkling on their hooks.
"Face the facts."
"The facts! Facts! I live with the facts every single minute of every single day and night."
The doorbell was ringing. Helen's heels hurried through the house.
"Jesus Christ," Sam muttered.
Renee jumped up and raced around his room, dressing quickly. He put his razor and rolled-up tie into his pocket so he could shave at work. He'd leave while Dr. Reynolds' presence kept them both at bay. The driveway filled with a rumble that shook the walls. He peeked out his window and saw the garbage truck idling below as Josiah kissed Grandine Carson goodbye.
"You're late,"
he heard Sam say when she came into the kitchen.
"Miss LeChance said I could," Josiah replied.
"Well, she's awful mad. She said she needs someone she can depend on."
"She said that? Miss LeChance said that? After all I've done for her? Well, that's it. I'm..."
"No, no, no. Calm down, Josiah," Sam said. "I was only kidding. Helen says you can do what you want. In fact, she was just in here saying how you need a day off, but it was probably too late to call you."
"Really?"
"Really."
"Grandine's still collecting. I can hear him."
"Well, if you hurry, you can catch up with him."
"Will you tell Ms. LeChance thanks?"
"Sure, I'll tell her. Bye, Josiah."
The back door banged shut.
"Good morning, Renee,"
Sam said without looking up from his coffee as Renee came out of his room. Just then, Helen looked in past the swinging door.
"Where's Josiah? I need her."
Sam covered his mouth and shook his head.
"The dear dim girl said it was her day off."
"Her what?"
Helen gasped. Tears swelled in her eyes. Behind her, Dr. Reynolds called, and she stepped quickly back from the door. Sam looked at Renee and shrugged.
"You shouldn't have done that,"
Renee said.
"Tomorrow the axe may fall," Sam said with a grin. "But at least for today, I can sleep without her goddamn vacuum banging my door."
He winked.
"But thanks for the warning," he said, opening the newspaper.
He held it between them. Renee stood, rubbing his forearm. He opened his mouth, then changed his mind. It was between them two. There wasn't much here that involved him. He started for the door.
Hey, Reen, if you see any of my kids today, tell them their old man says hi.
You tell him yourself, he muttered.
The newspaper lowered slowly. Sam tilted his head with amusement.
Sore spot? Sorry, Reen. Didn't mean to offend you. You can tape up all the pictures you want, but they are my kids.
Reenie's lip trembled. He'd never felt more like hitting someone.
They're Marie's kids. She's the only one that deserves them, he said.
You got that right, Reenie, Sam called after him. You sure as hell got that right.
As he drove down the hill, he was thinking about the young woman on the phone last week. Since then, he'd tried every conceivable combination of numbers, sometimes dialing and redialing in a breathless frenzy. He could barely recall her voice, but he remembered every word she had spoken. The moment Reenie turned the corner, he saw the cruiser in front of the store. Officer Hines stood at the top step talking to Mr. Fredette, the building manager. The front door was open. They hurried down to his car as he pulled up to the curb.
Bad news, Reenie, Mr. Fredette gasped. You've been broken into. They came in through the cellar and they left by the front door.
Reenie raced into the store.
They busted a window, Mr. Fredette said on his heels. Jimmy called me at home.
Doesn't seem to be too much missing, Hines said.
Tom, Reenie called as he ran down the cellar stairs. Come on, Tom. Come on out. It's okay, Tom. I'm here now, Tom. Tom, he bellowed,
turning so suddenly he collided with Officer Hines, who had followed him into the musty cellar. Tom's untouched food and milk dishes were still on the landing by the door. Maybe he was hiding up in the store. He opened every cupboard, looked behind every box and appliance, stretching his hand into the dirtiest crevices. Tom was gone.
Hines had spotted the front door ajar at 5:30 this morning. He must have escaped, either out the busted cellar window or the front door, Hines said.
Escaped. Reenie cringed. That made it sound as if Tom stayed only because he was locked up. Escaped, as if, like Riddles, Tom just couldn't wait to get away. Chief Stoner came through the door with Mr. Fredette and Hines both talking to him at once. Reenie looked out at the empty street.
So what's the story, Reenie?
Stoner asked. He shrugged. He couldn't talk now. Everything was too thin. His voice, his strength, the air. Mr. Fredette took it upon himself to explain that Reenie felt bad because Tom had escaped. Sonny interrupted to ask if anything else was missing besides the cat. Conscious of Sonny's stern gaze, Reenie went down into the cellar and looked in the crevice under the stairs. It was gone. His secret cash box was gone.
No, he said, standing up. Nothing I can see.
He couldn't very well admit to $300 that wasn't even on the books, now could he? He shuddered at the thought of the IRS examining all his records again, searching through his private life.
What about inventory?
Sonny asked, picking up an electric razor.
Any of that missing?
Reenie glanced around.
Nothing's missing.
The chief put the razor down so hard it banged on the counter. He looked terrible. He was unshaven and his eyes were bloodshot and puffy.
Why don't you look around, Reenie, and be sure, he said,
picking up the razor and setting it down again gently, then fiddling with it, moving it a hair to the left, as if to balance it with something. Reenie glanced over both shoulders.
I'm sure. Everything's here, except Tom, he added,
fidgeting under the chief's steady gaze. He wished they'd leave so he could start searching. Maybe Tom was just hiding out in the alley. If he put the food dishes on the back steps, then Tom would know it was safe to return. He opened the cellar door.
Kitty,
he whispered.
Come on, kitty, 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 kitty,
he called softly as he bent to pick up the dishes. A hand grasped the back of his shirt and tugged him upright.
Reenie,
Chief Stoner barked, his tight jaw quivering. His forefinger stabbed the air for emphasis.
A crime has been committed here, and this is an investigation, and we need your help here now. And you damn well better give it, do you understand?
Reenie took a deep breath.
I just want to find my cat, that's all, he whispered, the loss swamping his voice.
You will, Reenie. Tom'll come back. I know he will, Mr. Friedette piped.
Stoner closed his eyes and sighed.
I'm sorry about the cat, but you see, we have a pretty good idea who's breaking in all these places, but so far I got nothing concrete.
He explained that if things were missing, and if the suspect still had them, then they'd have the proof necessary to make an arrest.
Reenie walked around the store and checked each display. He counted boxes on shelves, not because he knew exactly how many should be there, but to demonstrate his cooperation. Hines had gone back down into the cellar with Mr. Friedette. Reenie stopped and glanced back at the empty shelf next to the stoves. The mix-made set was gone, and so was the box. The thief had even taken the box.
Chief,
he called, hurrying to the top of the cellar stairs. Behind him, a door creaked. Oh, God. Oh, no. Sonny carried a telephone book as he emerged from the bathroom. Reenie explained that the mix-made set was missing.
He must have packed it back in the box, he said, as the chief came toward him with a strange expression. Probably because of all the parts, you know, beaters and whips. Not only that, but there's four different size bowls. See? He cried, thrusting a mix-made pamphlet at Stoner. And covers, too.
He cleared his throat while Sonny glanced at the glossy brochure before slipping it into his breast pocket. The silence between them grew, while downstairs the muffled voices seemed to scurry underfoot like the mice Tom hunted.
I almost could have sold it last week. Bob Haddad said he wanted to buy it.
What's this all about, Reenie?
Sonny asked. Reenie stared, shaking his head, teeth clenched. Sonny put on his glasses. He wet his finger and turned the pages.
Eunice Bonifant, he said, looking over the rims. You call her, don't you, Reenie?
He nodded, unable to look away.
Sometimes at 5, huh? But mostly at night, around 11. Sometimes St. Mary's bells are ringing when you call.
Sonny sighed.
You still call her, Reenie?
He shook his head. In the last few weeks, Eunice had sworn and slammed down the phone the minute she heard his voice.
Mrs. Tinsdale, Mrs. Block, Mrs. Cherno, Klubach, Hearing? My God, you call all these women? Reenie, do you know what could happen? Don't you know this is against the law?
The voices rose and fell downstairs. Sonny talked and talked, and Reenie absorbed every accusation and chastisement, though it wasn't necessary. Like an excised organ, some vital part of him was already beginning to shrivel up. It was gone, all of it, over, and with the loss, he was shrinking. He grew smaller and smaller, so small that he was surprised when Sonny continued to speak to him. Helen didn't care what he did or where he went. No one did. Strangely, the truth, instead of hurting, came as a relief, an unburdening. As a rule, people did not like him, and no matter how hard he tried, nothing, nothing could ever change that basic fact. He felt so light now, so weightless, that he gripped the counter edge to anchor himself. It was over, 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 over. That's why Tom had run away.
No more calls, Reenie. You understand? Well, do you?
He nodded, eyes downcast. He kept nodding.
Sometimes things happen, things a man wouldn't ever do if he was thinking straight, Sonny said.
He glanced toward the cellar door. They were coming back up. Sonny grabbed his arm.
Believe me, I know. I know, he insisted.
Are you going to put me in jail?
Reenie gasped, his tears distorting everything. The two men came through the door with blurred features.
Course I'm not, Stoner said softly.
Tom'll be back, Reenie. You'll see, Mr. Friedette said,
his voice shrill with indignation.
You were damn good to that cat, and he knows it.
He patted Reenie on the back.
And me, I'm always around, Hines said. I'm bound to see him.
Sonny assured him the thief would be under arrest in just a few more days. It was only a matter of time. From now on, he and his men were going to come down so hard on a certain individual, he wasn't even going to be able to crap anymore without them knowing it.
Come on, Jimmy, Sonny
said, patting the pamphlet in his pocket.
Let's go see what kind of cake is Ma's making.
After they left, Reenie poured fresh milk into Tom's bowl. He opened a can of tuna fish and emptied it into a dish. Some of the tuna chunks were blood-streaked. He had cut his finger on the jagged edge of the can. He squeezed the cut and let it bleed onto the tuna. Maybe the blood would be an even stronger lure, and then he would be a part of Tom, and Tom would stay with him forever.
He set both dishes outside the back door.
"Open the door, Mrs. Carper. This is Officer Jimmy Hines speaking, and I got the chief here with me, too, Chief Stoner."
"I know who you are, and I'm not opening the door,"
she hollered back. Okay, now it was his turn.
"You have to, Hildy," Sonny said. "It's the law, and you just have to, that's all. Now open up. All we want to do is look around."
"Well, I'm not letting you. This is my home, and there's nothing here to see."
"Want me to?"
Hines hissed, gesturing his shoulder at the door. Sonny shook his head no.
"Blue in there?"
he called.
"If you're looking for him, you came to the wrong place,"
she said disgustedly.
"Well, actually, I'm looking for something. Something he brought here."
"What's that?"
He paused, considering how much to tell her.
"A mix maid,"
he read from the pamphlet.
"That's an electric mixer, a kind of beater,"
he said, wincing at her sour laughter.
"There's no mix maid here, I can tell you that much,"
she said with a derisive hoot. Telling her he'd have to see for himself, he rattled the knob. When she didn't respond, he nodded at Hines, who drew back eagerly. Just then the door opened, and her angular, freckled face stared up at them. A pretty woman. She looked a lot like Blue, but she was tiny, he realized, as he stepped past her. With the shades drawn, the house was dark, surprisingly neat. A lot cleaner than his own, he noted. Her two younger sons sat on the couch reading comic books.
"How you doing, boys?" he said. "Could you maybe sit out on the porch a minute till we call you back in?"
But their mother insisted they stay put.
"They got no use for their brother. He's a no good, and they're better off knowing it."
The boys watched with sober, impassive expressions. She led Sonny and Hines into the small kitchen, where she threw open every cupboard door, one after another, then went back and slammed them all shut.
"See? I told you," she said.
"Where's that go?"
Sonny pointed to a door.
"The cellar," she said.
"That where you keep the booze?"
he asked, and she darted to place herself between him and the door. He reached behind her and pulled it open. He counted 10 cases of beer stacked at the foot of the stairs.
"That's my private property," she said from behind. "I can keep 100 cases here if I want."
She had him there, for now anyway.
"What you're doing here is wrong, Hildy. Not only that," he said, pointing at her boys, "but what about them?"
"You get out of here," she growled, "and leave me the hell alone."
"I don't know," he sighed. "That's just getting harder and harder to do lately with people."
They were getting into the cruiser when Hines told Sonny he'd be right back. He'd just thought of a way Mrs. Carper could help them, and maybe herself as well. The sun set a minute earlier every night. Here on the winding mountain roads it seemed dark already, even though it was only 7:30. Blue Mooney was on his way to his mother's house. He had spent the last few days looking for work in Burlington. At least up there, the minute he said his name, doors didn't slam in his face. Two prospects looked good. One was for a moving company, and the other on a demolition crew for a small company that specialized in large buildings. That was the job he wanted most. It not only paid twice what he'd gotten from Coulter, but it contracted for projects all over the country. At first, he thought the interviewer was a wise son of a bitch, until he realized the guy was pushing him, testing his steadiness. He could tell the guy was impressed. He had given both places his mother's telephone number. If he did get a job in Burlington, he planned to surprise Alice Vermoyle one night at her dorm. He'd be all dressed up like a college guy himself, in a suit and a tie, and he'd hand her a dozen long-stemmed red roses and take her out to eat in the classiest restaurant in Burlington. As he came up the last hill to his mother's house, two cars loaded with kids roared past.
His hands tightened on the wheel. Both cars slowed as they approached the house. The bug light was off, so the cars drove on. Smiling, he pulled into the driveway. His youngest brother, Carl, was playing cards. His other brother, Peter, lay on the floor watching television. They glanced up warily as he greeted them.
"Where's Ma?"
he asked, hearing her voice like a low tremble in the walls.
"In there," Carl said, pointing toward the kitchen. "She's mad as hell," Peter said. "She's trying to get a job."
"No kidding,"
he said, grinning.
"Where you been?" Carl wanted to know.
"All over."
He smiled, pleased that he'd been missed. The older they got, the better he liked them, though he was amazed the way she was dressing them up in chino pants and button-down shirts, trying to make them look like town boys. At least they didn't have crew cuts. He knelt down and gave Peter a playful jab in the shoulder.
"Ow!"
Peter cried, shrinking back. Outside, a car honked its horn, then drove off. Maybe someone he knew had seen his car.
"Here, hit me back,"
he offered, hiking up his sleeve.
"Go ahead, hard as you can. Come on."
He laughed as Peter pummeled his arm.
"See, I can take it. I'm not crying. Ow, 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 like some faggot. Come on, I'll take the two of you."
He hooked his arm around Carl's legs and pulled him onto the floor. He covered his head and giggled as they began to tickle him. It was an old game. In the entire world, only these two little boys knew he was ticklish.
"Oh, God," he squealed. "Oh, God, stop it, stop it."
They were laughing so hard they kept collapsing onto him.
"You're the faggot,"
they gasped, scrabbling their fingers under his arms and down his sides.
"No, no, I'm not," he cried. "You are."
"You are,"
they said. Outside, a car had pulled in alongside the fence. A horn honked for the third time. He sat up so suddenly that the boys rolled onto the floor, but by the time he got to the door, the car had raced off, its tires spinning dirt and gravel back against the fence slats.
"Hildy!"
someone shouted from the car. He ran into the kitchen where his mother was talking on the phone.
"Somebody's here," she said, holding his stare. "I gotta go."
She hung up and lit a cigarette.
"Ma, what's going on? They're out there honking their horns and calling your name."
She picked a shred of tobacco from the tip of her tongue. She took a long, steadying drag.
"What do you want?"
she said, exhaling smoke through her mouth and nose. He explained what had just happened. If they did it again, he said, he was going out there with a sledgehammer, and then, remembering, he smiled and gestured behind him.
"But the kids said you've been looking for a job." "That's great, Ma."
"Yeah? And did they tell you why? Did they tell you how the police ride by here every 5 minutes? How one's probably parked up in the grove right now?"
she growled as she stepped toward him now, jabbing her finger in his chest.
"They tell you how the chief and a cop went through the house looking for that electric mixer you stole?"
"What are you talking about? What electric mixer?"
"You're so damn worried about them in there. How do you think they felt seeing their whole house searched?"
"What mixer? What the hell are you talking about?"
he bellowed in her face, enraged at the thought of cops humiliating his family. She told him about the break-in at the appliance store, and since then the steady stream of cruisers by here. He swore he hadn't broken into the appliance store, or anywhere else for that matter.
"Not since the gas station,"
he added quickly before she could say it.
"Just like Kyle. You're nothing but trouble, Travis, and I can't have you around. It's that simple," he laughed.
"All you ever believe about me is what people tell you."
"I tried, but there's a limit, and I'm at it now."
"You tried. Yeah, you tried real hard when you let them send me to reform school."
"Let them? What the hell could I do? You and your brother were always stealing and breaking windows and—"
"Ma, I was 8 years old. The same as them in there. You could have done something. You could have tried."
"What? What could I have done?" she screamed.
"You know, all I ever wanted those 5 years was one thing."
He looked at her.
"Just one thing."
She stared up at him.
"You know what that was?"
he asked, but she didn't even blink.
"You don't want to know, do you?"
he said with a bitter laugh. He was both relieved and embarrassed. He felt flat. There was a loaf of bread on the counter, so he took a slice, then opened the refrigerator for the butter. All but the top shelf was jammed with beer bottles. He spread the butter, determined to ignore the beer. The police couldn't be too much of a harassment, he thought.
"How's Kenny?"
he asked, trying to get things back on track. Kenny was Carl and Peter's father. She called him her husband, but he doubted there had ever been a marriage. Summers, Kenny was a logger in Maine. Off-season, he collected unemployment and fixed cars on the side, but at least he was around some of the time for Carl and Peter. When Kenny was here, Blue stayed away. They'd never gotten along. His own father had died in a roofing fall soon after Blue's birth. He sat at the table and told her how Sonny, like everybody else in town, had it in for him. It'd be a help, he said, if she'd just listened to his side of it for once. He tried to explain what had happened with his D.I., but it was hard because she kept going to the window, and then she'd pace back and forth, smoking and sighing. He was losing his train of thought. He didn't want to get her mad again. So far, she'd let him do all the talking, and it felt good. He was telling her things he'd put out of his thoughts for months, years even. He was hopping so from subject to subject that he was afraid she was getting confused. She looked distracted. A couple of times she went into the other room and yelled at the boys to turn down the television. He smiled now as she passed him. In spite of her harsh way and the bad dye job, she was a good-looking lady. It pleased him that they had the same wide mouth and square chin. She stood by the window again. She leaned forward as if peering at something, then came quickly to the table and sat across from him. Maybe it would be the same with Alice Vermoyle. It would take persistence. He was just going to have to keep coming back and coming back, no matter the obstacles.
"I think I got a job in Burlington, Ma," he said.
He told her about the demolition company, exaggerating their interest in him.
"You shouldn't have screwed up with Coulter," she said.
She sat way back in the chair and looked toward the window.
"Yeah, well, listen, Ma, I gave them your number here to call."
She glanced back at him.
"You're not moving in. I told you that."
"No, I just want you to take a message, Ma, that's all."
He smiled.
"You know, just take a message."
She chewed her lip. A car was slowly passing the house. Its headlights shone on the wall behind her, and she looked up.
"I just want you to know," she began, then shook her head with frustration.
"What? What?"
he kept asking, a knot in his throat. She had been twisting her fingers, and now she stared at him both defiantly and fearfully.
"That electric mixer. I mean, if it was for me, I could understand. You could give it to me. Then I could understand. It would make sense."
She kept wetting her lips. She tried to swallow, and her eyes widened.
"Do you have it?"
she asked, her voice so thin it seemed to seep out of her.
"Or maybe you could go get it and bring it here."
He rubbed his eyes a minute. They hurt. Right now, everything hurt. Yet he couldn't help laughing.
"You're a real sweet Ma, you know that, don't you?"
"Well," she shook her head and sighed, and now couldn't look at him. They both looked toward the window as a car braked to a squealing stop in front of the house. He stood up.
"What would you do with the mixer, Ma? Make me something? A cake or a pie or something?"
He chuckled.
"Tell you the truth, I didn't even know you wanted a mixer. But now that I do, I'm going to get you one."
He went to the front door and flipped the switch. The bug bulb flooded the little porch and the yard and the road with warm yellow light.
"Hey!"
he called down to the three couples in somebody's daddy's big new red sedan.
"How much do you need?"
3 6-packs,
called back the girl in the front seat. Her short blonde hair was cut like a boy's.
"Be right out,"
he said, aiming his finger like a gun. The girls in the car laughed. The boys watched warily.
"No,"
his mother said, turning off the light and slamming the door shut.
"You can't."
"Ma, there's customers out there."
She followed him into the kitchen, continuing to insist. No, he couldn't. Not tonight. The cops. They kept coming by looking for him. He had filled his pockets, and now he was loading more cold bottles into his arms.
"They're not just looking for me, Ma,"
he said, opening the door. Carl and Peter watched from the couch.
"They want me with an electric mixer, right? That's your deal with them, right? So why not do a little business? Don't let me stop you, Ma, he called as he went down to the car and unloaded the bottles into the blonde's lap. Whatever you got, he told the driver, who held out a $5 bill. Hey, the driver called as he started back toward the house. What about my change? Oh, yeah. He turned and fished the rest of the bottles from his pockets. Here you go. One after another, he hurled the bottles, smashing them on the car. Inside, the girls screamed and covered their faces. Beery crystals of foamy glass ran down the side of somebody's daddy's brand new car. Headlights flared on from the nearby grove, and then came the red roof lights with sirens as three cruisers raced in to surround the red sedan. Sorry, he said with upturned palms to the approaching policeman. No mixer. I just been too busy selling beer to these miners here. He looked back at his mother's cold face in the doorway. His brothers watched from the window. Sorry, Ma, but maybe you can go back to business now. He saw Officer Hines wince, and he laughed. That was the deal, right? Sorry, beautiful, he called, bending to the blonde, who sobbed out her name to one of the policemen. Come on, Hines said, nudging him toward his cruiser. Hey, where's my hero? He said, looking around. Where's Sonny? Hines looked at him and took a deep breath. His wife just died, he said as he clamped handcuffs over his wrist. Ah, too bad. I'll bet that really broke old Sonny's heart, huh? He chuckled with the image of Eunice Bonifant's fist plunged down the back of the good chief's trousers. You bastard! You no good son of a bitch! Hines cried, pummeling the side of his head, the blow so sudden and sharp that he sank to his knees, his eyes rolling as his head bobbed up and down. He toppled onto his side. His mother stepped back, and with the click of a deadbolt, the door closed, and all the windows came down in the little gray house, and then all the shades, and the yellow bug light went out, and then it was dark, mercifully dark. The morning paper had been thrown on the dewy grass, and now the wet pages kept tearing as Robert Haddad looked for the obituaries. Here it was, Carol Stoner. The picture was of a younger, happier woman whose smile seemed to mock him. Her policy was for $20,000. Every time the phone rang, he held his breath and looked toward the kitchen where Astrid worked at the table. Sonny wouldn't call until after the funeral, so he had a few days anyway. First off, he'd tell him the company needed a death certificate. Then he'd explain how the submission and processing were often delayed by red tape. But the chief couldn't be put off for too long. Haddad figured he might have a week, 2 weeks, a month at most. And then what? Where the hell was he going to get $20,000? Of course, this whole thing was eventually going to blow up in his face. Hadn't he known that? Now he needed a big hit. What had he been thinking? Holy shit. He'd leave, that's what he'd do, just start driving. But she'd never come. No, this had been his big chance. It just wasn't fair. Here she was, happy with him for the first time since their wedding night, oblivious to the shame and ruin that lay ahead. Okay, okay. He had to stay calm and try to think straight. There had to be a way to put this all back together. And once he had, everything would be on the up and up. Everything. He wouldn't put so much as a penny of petty cash into his pocket. The thing was, the difference here, the reason he deserved a chance to set this straight was that he wasn't a criminal. It had all been circumstance, lousy timing, one bad break after another. Same thing had happened to Jimmy Saltner at the Chevy dealership, plowing his sales receipts into the big new house, the snooty wife, the kids' prep schools, the girlfriend's surgery. Cover here, patch up there, until the bank's knocking on the front door while Jimmy's sucking a hose down in the garage. Well, not him. No, sir. He'd use his head and wrench this runaway life back on track. What he needed here was a big hit, a very, very big hit, and from then on, no more. He'd take his lumps, get another job, selling used cars, mopping floors if he had to. Hell, he wasn't proud. Astrid wandered in again from the table where she had been making lists of people to invite to her soap parties. She planned to have one a week, 50 a year. There'd be refreshments, door prizes, games, entertainment.
What did he think? She mused, her rhinestone-studded glasses slipping down her nose as she studied the list for her first party.
I have so many names, she sighed. But what if I don't really know them?
Looking up, she frowned.
Bobby, what's wrong?
Mrs. Stoner died, he said, gesturing at the paper. The chief's wife, their policyholders. She kissed the top of his head.
Well, aren't you something caring so much for your customers?
She pointed to the picture on the page opposite the death notices.
I met him, she said, reading the caption. Mr. and Mrs. Cleveland Hines, co-chairs of the hospital's annual winter ball. He came in the store once.
He is president of the Atkinson Savings Bank, Haddad told her, adding as she scribbled the name onto her list. It's the second largest bank in the state.
Might as well go for the big ones, Astrid laughed, dotting the I with a flourish.
That's right, he said loudly, because suddenly the room seemed swollen with noise and turbulence. Mount's funeral home was crowded with mourners. The lot was full, so cars had begun to park on adjacent streets, some of which were no parking zones, but no one complained or called the police. Alice waited in the long line that moved slowly into the old brick building. She wore her graduation dress and her squeaky heels. She chewed the edge of her thumbnail, then winced when it tore too close to the flesh. She hated this. She didn't want to be here, didn't want to see Mrs. Stoner's corpse, and dreaded seeing Lester again. She'd been the first person he called.
My mother's dead,
he'd announced in a cold voice.
It just happened 5 minutes ago.
Oh, Les, she'd said, trying not to cry. I don't know what to say. I'm so sorry.
Well, I just thought you should know,
he'd said, his terse finality sickening her. All day long she had tried to look forward to tonight. It was her first night off in 3 weeks, and Joe had planned something special. She couldn't imagine what it might be, since the Monsignor had been at the lake for 2 days with his cousin Nora Hines. Her son Bernard was sick again. The Monsignor would be celebrating Mrs. Stoner's funeral mass the day after tomorrow, but then he was headed straight back to the lake. The Monsignor had left Joe completely in charge, which meant he couldn't see her during the day or pick her up after work. He'd gone on every sick call and kept all the Monsignor's counseling appointments. Joe had been pressuring her so much lately with all his talk of their life together that not seeing him these last few days had been a relief. People at work were giving her funny looks, and last week her mother had demanded to know why she was spending so much time with a priest. The more she insisted they were friends, the more convinced her mother was that all the convent talk was true. Now she and her mother were barely speaking. The line moved ahead. Once inside, she found it wasn't nearly as upsetting as she'd expected. The woman in the pale blue satin folds was so thin that all of her bones ridged up against her dress, and her skin was an eerie pearly white, and a few dry wisps of her own hair straggled out from under the wig. And yet this woman certainly looked more like Mrs. Stoner than Mrs. Stoner had in the last few months. Chief Stoner stood by the casket. His eyes were red, but his voice was clear as he thanked everyone for coming and shook each hand.
Alice, he said as the man in front of her stepped away. Oh, Alice, how nice of you to come, he said, taking her hands in his.
I'm awfully sorry, she whispered. Mrs. Stoner was always very nice to me.
He shook his head and sniffed.
She was crazy about you, Alice. She thought you were the best thing that ever happened to Les.
He wiped away tears.
She hoped. She wanted. She thought.
He took a deep breath.
Poor Carol. She didn't deserve any of this.
He sobbed, and her face flamed as a hush fell over the room.
I'm sorry, she said again. I'm awfully sorry.
It felt as if she were apologizing for everything, for Mrs. Stoner's suffering, for leaving Les, for causing the chief's worst grief. A man and a woman she recognized as Les's aunt and uncle from Providence came up then to stand with the distraught chief.
I'm sorry, she said to the aunt, who put her arm around his waist. I'm very sorry, she said to the uncle, who nodded.
She moved gratefully along.
Les is out back, the chief called after her. He needs to see you.
She found Lester in a tiny sitting room next to the office. He sat on the gold love seat with a pile of wadded tissues on his lap, his eyes bloodshot, his nose red and swollen. He could breathe only through his mouth.
I had to leave, he gasped. I just couldn't do it anymore. Oh, Les, I'm so sorry.
She hated seeing him like this. He was probably regretting all the times he'd been irritable with his mother. She sat down and tried to make him feel better by recalling the night they'd played cards with his mother and the times they'd had lemonade together and the time his mother had showed them her high school yearbook and pretended to be so offended when they kept laughing at the weird clothes and hairstyles. He covered his face.
I'm all alone, he sobbed, and I can't stand it.
You've got your father. He's such a nice man, and he needs you, Les, especially now, she said.
His head shot up. He doesn't need me. All he needs is me to forgive him. But I won't. I never will. His mouth was white and quivering.
Les, I know. It's the same as my father, only it's not even forgiveness he wants. It's understanding, and that's almost worse. At least forgiveness means it's over. My father just wants me to keep putting up with it.
At least your father's not a hypocrite, he spat. He is what he is. He doesn't go around preaching honor and responsibility like my father did the whole time he was screwing my aunt while my poor mother laid in her bed night after night crying. But the worst thing is, he used me. He didn't have to feel so guilty if I was with her. And that way it didn't look so bad. And that's the most important thing, what people think of good Chief Stoner. But no matter what he does or what he says, I know the truth about him. I know just how bad he is.
Spittle foamed in the corners of his mouth. His eyes glittered.
And he can't stand that, he whispered, almost gloating.
Les!
It was an effort to look at him. The hair on her arms bristled. She had to get out of here.
Oh, Les! She stood up. Les, all of that's over now.
He put his head back and closed his eyes. The floorboards creaked outside as people passed through the corridor.
I'm leaving for the seminary in 2 weeks, he said. That's probably the best thing, then. Just get away from everything here.
He stood up as she moved to the door. His shoulders heaved up and down as he began to cry.
Alice, will you hold me? Just hold me, that's all. Oh, poor Les,
she said with a limp embrace where only cheeks touched, his squeezily hot and damp against hers, and she was ashamed of the revulsion she felt. Her face reddened as she came up the street toward the rectory. She stared at her aunt's house, praying no one was watching now as she turned onto the rectory walk. In the time it took to get to the side door, she cringed with toes bunched, eyes almost closed, begging through clenched teeth,
Please hurry, please hurry, please, please hurry.
Joe grinned as she stepped into the warm kitchen. Lidded pans were on the stove, and she could smell onions and meat roasting in the oven. Joe wore a blue button-down shirt with his clerical pants and black shoes. The long, lace-covered table in the dining room was set for two, with silver flatware, pale blue and white china, gold-rimmed crystal, linen napkins, and a silver candelabrum that held 5 slender candles. In the middle of the table were gladioli and white carnations in a stuccoed basket she knew must have come from the church. Mrs. Arkaday had the night off. Alice was relieved that this was the surprise. No matter where they went, even if they were just in the car late at night, there was always the fear of being recognized by a parishioner. The fear made her not only nervous but bitchy, she realized an hour later, as she couldn't stop laughing at Joe's word, fiency, on the Scrabble board.
Sorry, no such word. I never heard of it.
Fiency, he said, getting up to check the roast beef again. His apron was a dish towel tucked into his pants. That's what Howard Menke said his sister has now that she's engaged to Carson. A fiency.
It has to be in the dictionary, she said, laughing.
Look it up if you insist,
he called, and she smiled, watching him hurry down the hallway. He wanted everything to be perfect. She wasn't to lift a finger or to worry about a single thing. He had even made her feel better about seeing Lester at the funeral home. Joe said Lester was taking out his own guilt and resentment of his mother's illness on his father, and also, in a sense, on her. He wants to be rescued. That's what that was all about, Joe had said, and for some reason the words kept surfacing.
He wants to be rescued.
Yes, she thought as he came back to the table. We all do.
They were midway through dinner when the phone rang.
Oh, no, no, please, not a sick call,
Joe groaned, hurrying into the kitchen to answer it. She could hear him laughing.
Just Mrs. Arkaday checking to make sure everything's all right, he said, returning to the table.
He sat down and replaced his napkin in his lap with an irritating fussiness.
She hopes you like the roast beef. She ordered the cut special.
Alice gulped. She knows I'm here? Mrs. Arkaday knows I'm here? He smiled.
She thinks I'm cooking dinner for Father Krestecki.
But what happens when she sees Father Krestecki and asks him how he liked dinner?
Oh, he hardly ever comes here, he said with a wave of his fork.
But when he does, she'll...
Don't worry about it, he interrupted.
He leaned across the table and touched her cheek.
I'm not,
he said, his wide grin startling her. How could he not worry when lately it was all she thought about? He confused her. Sometimes it seemed his priesthood was a miserable trap in which he felt hopelessly snared. And then there would be times like this, as he spoke of counseling Bernie Hines, the Monsignor's young cousin, that his words rang together and his brow beaded with sweat, and his zeal and enthusiasm made her squirm. Last week Bernie had refused to go to Albany for any more treatments, which he said only made him sicker. Nora Hines had called in tears, begging the Monsignor to come at once to talk to him. Everyone had tried, but Bernie was adamant, Joe said, pouring more wine into their glasses. I don't know if I blame him after seeing what Mrs. Stoner went through, she said.
Well, yeah, he conceded with a wave of his fork. But he's just a kid. He's got to keep trying.
But why, if it just means more suffering and he'll never get better? She'd already heard this story their last time together, and it had irritated her as much then as now.
But that's not the point. You don't just give up. You fight. You fight back, he said, eyes gleaming.
But why? She persisted. In moments like this, there seemed a strange blankness in him.
My God, Alice, you know why,
he said with another wave of his fork, impatient to continue. Yes, she knew why. Because Joe needed to be a hero, she thought, drinking more wine. That was his passion, to be a savior, and it was also the void.
So when all else failed, I asked if I could try, and the Monsignor figured, well, why the hell not?
He sipped his wine.
I'll never forget it, walking into that huge stone house, down that long hallway, opening the door into that dark room, and there he was, sitting on his bed, not only stark naked, but so hairless, with this terrible white skin, like a radioactive ghost. That's all I could think of, he whispered, taking another sip. A shining ghost, I kept thinking. He's already died. He's dead, and they don't even know it. But you see, I knew it. The minute I walked in there, I knew it. And I told him, I said, Bernie, your problem isn't your body. It's something here, isn't it?
He whispered, tapping his breast and staring as if she were the dying boy whose reply he now awaited, chin out, brow raised. She drank her wine, drank more, filled her mouth with water, swishing to get rid of the bitter aftertaste now as he related the conversation that had left Bernie curled in his mother's arms, sobbing and begging for help. Joe had told him he was a spoiled rich brat who had never learned to fight back, who expected everything, including his recovery, handed to him on a silver tray.
It's time for the hard fight, I told him. Time to find out not whether he can get better, not whether he's going to be cured, but whether or not he's got the guts to live.
She held her breath. The flickering candlelight deepened the cleft in his chin, the hollows round his piercing eyes, the tuft of black hair at his throat. His husky voice darkened with the wine and made her shiver. It's all right, she thought. He was a priest, and in spite of everything, always would be a priest, maybe even a better one for all of this. She felt not only safer with him when he seemed most priestly, but oddly enough, in this moment, more womanly, more alive than she had ever felt. She took another sip, this time savoring the lushness in her mouth. Every nerve tingled. Her eyelids were heavy. She smiled and pushed away her plate. He was telling her how grateful the Monsignor had been.
He offered me a weekend off with my family, but I said not now. I thought I'd wait till you got up to school, and then maybe I'd take the time then, you know? Stay someplace up there, the two of us.
She tried to smile, but now she was very tired. It was the wine. She had had alcohol only once before, a few sips of beer with Mary Agnes. She thought of her father, but not with the awful guilt she had experienced in Mary Agnes's cellar. She had often wondered how he could give up his family and all that mattered for the sake of some foul-tasting liquid. At least now, at this moment anyway, it didn't seem quite the incomprehensibly selfish choice it usually did.
"Would you like dessert?"
Joe asked. He had asked a previous question she had not answered, then had quickly forgotten.
"I have chocolate cake."
"No, thank you," she said, making every effort to speak distinctly. Her tongue felt too big for her mouth. "I'm very full."
"You hardly ate," he said, looking at her.
The meal was delicious." She smiled. "I mean it." She stretched back with a deep groan. He suggested coffee, but she didn't want any. Just the smell of it was making her stomach feel funny. The phone rang. While he was gone, she braced her cheek on her fist and catnapped. He was back. She looked up, startled and trembling. He said it was someone from out of town wanting to know what time the early mass was tomorrow. She watched him clear the table. He was telling her about a priest named Valecci who had been in his first parish with him. Valecci had called the other day to invite him up to his new parish, which was on a lake where they could go fishing. He paused, and she was conscious of him looking at her, but she had been thinking of something else.
"So what that boy's father think you did? The one you gave the jacket to? You never said," she asked, peering at him.
"I don't know. I guess he..."
Joe stammered. He was annoyed with her. The other night he had accused her of daydreaming while he was telling her about his most recent meeting with the bishop.
"I don't know what he thought."
"He thought you were queer," she giggled. "He did, didn't he? I know that's what it was, so you might as well admit it," she said smugly.
She liked this honesty, this getting things out in the open, like a cool, clear stream running straight through her, delivering her thoughts so smoothly she did not have to grope for or censor a word.
"I don't know what he thought,"
Joe said. He carried more dishes into the kitchen. She blinked as the door swung in and out, its diminishing arc leaving her stranded and alone out here.
"Joe,"
she called, cringing with the thickness of her voice.
"I'm sorry. I hurt your feelings, didn't I? Joe?"
"I'm right here,"
he said, backing through the door with a cup of milky coffee for her. There was something she had to say, but he urged her to drink the coffee. It was something no one ever talked about. Like the boy in the jacket, there was always a part left out.
"You know what it is, don't you?"
she asked, bending low to sip from the edge of the dripping cup.
It's sex. That's what the problem is. That's what's so stupid."
"Drink your coffee," he said, gesturing for her to lift the cup.
"Well, it is. It just makes everything so complicated and so dirty."
"No, Alice," he said patiently. "It's natural. It's part of living, like eating and sleeping."
He didn't understand. And now she was losing her train of thought. She looked at him and started to cry.
"But sometimes I feel like some animal that gives off this smell. It makes me sick. and every time I say the same thing, I vow I'll never do it again. It's so wrong. And then every night when I'm with you, I can't help it. I can't stop myself. It feels like I'm out of control, and the harder I try not to, the better it feels. And then I'm so ashamed. Sometimes I even walk funny. I try to keep my legs close together.
Alice?
No, listen. I know this is a weird thing to say, but I don't know who else to ask.
What?
He looked frightened.
She rubbed her eyes, then scratched the back of her head.
Well, oh, God,
she moaned, rolling her eyes.
I don't know how to say this.
Then just say it. Whatever it is, say it.
He kept swallowing and taking deep breaths.
Is there a smell? Do I smell? Is that what happens? Is that how men can tell? How could you tell?
Alice, what have I done to you?
He came around the table and sat close to her.
Men can't tell anything. There's no odor. It's not like a dog in heat. It's not dirty. It's beautiful. You don't smell. You're the sweetest, purest, most wonderful person I know. Don't cry. Please don't. There's nothing wrong with you, honey. Believe me. I love you. And love isn't dirty, Alice. It's not wrong.
She looked up and wailed with this soreness in her chest. She had to tell him. The thing was, the terrible, terrible thing was that she didn't love him. She didn't love anyone.
Come here, baby. You're upset, you're tired, and you've had too much wine. Come here. Let me take care of you. Let me hold you,
he whispered as they climbed the stairs to his quiet room, to his dark bed with its cool, bleached linen. He eased down beside her, curled against him. She drifted in and out of sleep as he kissed her ear, her eyes, her mouth, her throat. He stroked the length of her arms to the damp, tender skin between each finger. He helped her unbutton her dress. She heard him move away and lay it neatly on the chair. He took off his own clothes, then pulled the sheet over them.
I love you,
he whispered with every new place he touched and kissed.
You taste like flowers.
A wall rose around her, and in here nothing hurt. In here she was safe, as long as someone loved her and did not demand it back.
Ugh!
The Monsignor groaned with every rut and bump in the road, while his cousin Nora drove. He was doubled over with pain, his brow pressed against the dashboard. Nora kept insisting he go to the hospital. If I turn here, we could be there in 5 minutes, she said, slowing down. She wore a trench coat over her pajamas. He had come to her door at midnight.
No, I just need to get in my own bed, and then I'll be all right.
Damn, couldn't she ever take no for an answer? This was all her fault anyway. She knew he had no willpower when it came to food, and yet her cupboards were stocked with all manner of things he couldn't eat. At least Mrs. Arkaday had some sense. At least she took care of him. His own cousin didn't seem to care.
Maybe after a few days' rest you'll feel like coming back.
She looked over with a hopeful smile.
This is the first time all summer Bernard's come down to eat with us. It was just so wonderful being able to have a normal conversation with him, in spite of all his suffering.
He groaned, and with this for assent, she continued to babble about her son, Bernard. Bernard, the hell with Bernard! His head reeled with this pain knifing through his gut. Bernard had never had to endure anything like this. No one had. My God, what was this test, this latest trial?
Release me from this misery, I implore you. Shrink the gallstone. Make it disappear. Take it away. You can do this, Jesus, my sweet Jesus. Damn it, I know you can. I know you can, so do it. Do it.
Tom? She hit the brake, and he almost fainted with the car's sudden lurch. What is it, Tom?
Praying,
he grunted.
I'm praying.
Almost there, she kept assuring him, jamming on the brake at every stop, then accelerating ahead as if to demonstrate her full awareness of his misery.
"Almost there. Just a few more blocks."
The car swerved around another corner.
"Damn, why hadn't Cleve been there to drive him home?
Norris said he was at the bank preparing for the annual audit, but the Monsignor knew what it was. The town's most powerful Catholic found him boring."
"Here we go,"
Norris said, pulling into the rectory driveway and braking so sharply he almost fainted. She hurried around the front of the car. She had to unfold him to get him out. Doubled over and listing to one side, he walked with his arms girding his belly. He grew dizzier with every step he climbed. He was shocked when Nora switched on the kitchen light. A teetering pile of dirty dishes filled the sink. On the cutting board, an empty wine bottle stood in a puddle of condensation that puckered the familiar label, the precious Brecci Cordell he'd been saving for the day he was named bishop. Limp tomato slices shriveled on a plate, the season's first beefsteaks he'd been nurturing on the sunniest windowsill to full ripeness. On the stove were a sludgy gravy pan and a pot of cold gray potato water clotted with white scum. A new pain rose in his chest.
"Something's happened to Mrs. Arkaday,"
he groaned, groping along the